I've just come back from a wonderful tour of biblical sites in Jordan and Israel. And I've washed my feet in the Jordan River. I've swum in the Lake of Galilee. I've floated on the Dead Sea. I've stood on Mounts Nebo, Megiddo, Masada, Zion, Moriah, and the Temple Mount. Well, these are biblical places that are pinging for you. Very exciting. It was 14 days of wonder during which much of what I've read over the years came alive. Nothing like context. And I've come back excited about reading the Bible, both the Old Testament and the world of Jesus. I don't know if you got to the blog that I put on our church website, but if you go to our church website, the banner is there, and it will lead you to it. So every day I posted a description of places and some photos. Several places really gripped me, and they filled out the words that I knew from the scripture. Sometimes it's just one word that's being brought to us through the scriptures, and that it was something actual which it related to. And this morning I want to walk us through one place and listen to a text of what Jesus said there, because text and context come together. So, back to about a week and a half ago, two maps of the region there. One's a political map, and the other is as it was in the first century. So, one day we drove north from Galilee over the Golan Heights to the border with Lebanon. And we're going to a place known locally as Bunias. Bunias. On the map there, it's Caesarea Philippi, just up there on the Lebanon-Israeli border. And on the other map, it's there as well, but sort of halfway between Tyre and Damascus. So it's at the northern edge of Israel. And Bunias is a name. And I learned that in terms of archaeology, names are really important because they often preserve something, even in Arabic. Now, Arabs have problems saying P, apparently. Are there any Arab speakers here this morning? So P's become B's. So this records a place that was once known as Bunias, but now it's Bunias, and that the road signs still record that today. But on our map, the world that we're looking at, the world of Jesus, it's named Caesarea Philippi. And I'm going to bring all this together because it was in our gospel passage. So what are these place names about? Well, Bunias in Arabic and Bunias, as it was named in Greek, refers to one Greek god with a small g named Pan. More about him later. And so the cult of worshipping Pan came when the Greeks came, which was Alexander the Great around 300 BC. And Greek influence spread over the ancient world, including Israel. And the pagan Greeks brought with them their stories or their mythologies, all their kind of dreamy stories about gods and places and how life works. And what they did was they then associated their stories with places. So, in this case, the god Pan was associated with this place, a particular place there. It's a spring of water that gushes out of a cave that was part of a limestone ridge or a cliff face. And that spring of water was impressive. It was a lot of water, and it flowed into the Jordan River. And they perceived this place, as pagans often do, as a portal. I'm going to use that word a lot. A portal is sort of like a gateway. Now, the funny thing is, science fiction is all over this. We have wormholes, we have portals, we have sort of magic wardrobes, even C.S. Lewis, you know, you go in the wardrobe and you step into another world. It's an idea that's everywhere. Well, the pagan world looks for these portals, and it often thinks that they are in places of dramatic natural beauty. So a spring that comes out of the ground, you know, large amounts of water, it's like a portal to the underworld. Volcanoes were thought of that way too. Big fiery cauldrons. That's the way to the underworld. So the Greeks arrived 300 BC in Israel, found this spring that flowed out of a cave and identified it in their imagination as a portal to a place they named in Greek Hades. Hades was the place where the dead went and where the gods lived. So the gods lived underground, down there, in another world. Maybe they even knew enough geology to know that the deeper you go, the hotter it gets. I don't know. These places were referred to as the gates of Hades, portals, doorways into this other world. And consequently, that was what the Celts would much later refer to as a thin place. You're somehow close to the spirit world. You're close to where the gods are. That's a good place to worship. Very ancient thinking. That's a good way to reach out to the gods, because there's this crack in the wall, as it were, between our world and their world. So in the scriptures we'll get to later, I'll be commenting that actually the gates of hell is not a good translation of this. It brings too much later sort of baggage and thinking into it. So the Greeks had this idea as pagans of the gates of hell. Where do we go? Could I have the next screen? What happened? There we go. Thank you. So physically, that's what it looks like today. I can tell Barbara took that photo because that's me trudging on the left-hand side over there. So you've got this limestone ridge, and there's a terrace underneath it, and you see the remains of temples and things. I'll get to that later. And on the far left, there is this big hole in the ground. And that's what that cave looks like if you get up close. Today, there's no water coming out of it. Apparently, there was an earthquake somewhere, first few centuries after Christ, and what earthquakes often do is they shift the water flow in the subterranean. The water comes out the ground some meters further on now, and it sort of seeps out. It's still one of the places where the Jordan is fed, but it doesn't come rushing up out of this particular cave that the pagans decided was the gates of Hades, or a portal to the underworld. So people would come in front of this cave with its water gushing out to offer worship and sacrifices. And often that meant throwing something in there. So they may have prepared some food and put it in a special pot, and in she goes. They may have an animal. They may even have thrown people in there. And they stood in front of this area, and I don't want to review pagan practices, but I thought sex, drugs, and rock and roll describes it. All that stuff is typical pagan worship. It's how they elevated their experience and entered into what they thought they were doing. So they'd stand in front of a cave, and they'd throw something in. Now, if it was an animal, or in particular, if it floated back to the surface in these churning waters, they thought, oh, it's been rejected. The gods weren't happy with this. If it stayed sunk down somewhere towards the back of the cave, they concluded that it has been a good day in worship. The gods had accepted it. However, another thing could happen, and that is it sunk, but blood oozed out of the rocks in the other springs. And they also concluded that that meant that the sacrifice had been rejected. So this is pagan worship in the north of Israel from about 300 years before Jesus. And the next feature to note is that this portal to the underworld, this gateway to Hades, became associated with one god who I've mentioned. Now, I don't need to say much about Pan. He's a bit weird. Pan had goat features and was associated with wild places, a friend of shepherds and nymphs, if you know what they are. So he had a frustrated love life, and in the course of that, he invented the Pan flute, named after him. He was the one who was able to instill terror in people. And we still have that in English and in Dutch. That's where the word panic comes from. It goes back to the story and that mythology. So, Gates of Hades, down to the underworld, devoted to one particular Greek god. And this is happening in northern Israel. So this cult ran at these gates from early on until the Romans arrived in 63 BC. So we're getting close to Jesus now. We're less than a century before Jesus. The Romans were very pragmatic people. They made straight roads. And their approach to religion and power was to sort of merge them together. And wherever they went, they sort of took the existing religions and said, well, we have something like that. And they flowed with what there was, relabeled it a bit, and then played some power architecture with it. So the one who did that in Israel most was Herod the Great. Now, Herod was a local client king, and he for political reasons, he really worked hard to basically say to Octavian, Caesar, Augustus, I love you. And he did this by building temples everywhere to the divine Caesar. So guess what? You have a site like this. It's seen as a gateway to the underworld. The Greeks have spent several centuries establishing that. How about we make this into a city? We name it after Caesar, Caesarea Philippi, and we put a temple there to Caesar. So the plum place to put that, the best piece of real estate to place your temple to the divine Caesar, is right in the middle in front of that cave. So that's what Herod does. And in fact, it was a temple where the back wall was missing, and it sort of that opened up the cave. So in my thinking, you have to go through Roman power to get to this portal to the underworld. This is how religion was, pagan religion and politics were managed. So we have a picture here which actually goes to about the 3rd century, because what happened was they started building things in front of the portal on the left. You can see the outline of the cave. And over the next 2 or 3 centuries, they just keep going to the right with various temples and things like that. It was a real circus. If you started on the left, you had the temple to the divine Caesar in front of the grotto to the underworld, and then you had the court of Pan, so an area that was just for honoring the god Pan. And then after Jesus, there came a temple to Zeus, a court of Nemesis, the tomb of the sacred goats, and then the temple of Pan and the dancing goats. Can you imagine having dancing goats as part of your worship? Well, they did. Okay, so it was a real circus. So this is what I saw. This is the cave is on the left, and to the right is the courtyard that was assigned to the worship of Pan, and people cut niches into the rock to place various statues and things like that. So that's an introduction to the context, the place. Jesus goes there. We're told he's in the region. Whether he actually walked right up to the cave, I don't know. But he was there, and both Matthew and Mark refer to it. He's a long way from home. And he's taken his disciples not far short of Damascus. He's deep into pagan territory. This is not an area full of synagogues and indications of Jewish life and activity. And he's close to these much celebrated geological features that pagans make so much of, where capricious gods and the powers of death live. And it's all about this rock with a spring in it. And he was in a city dedicated to the Roman emperor as having divine qualities, with a temple to his worship. He is a Galilean rabbi on the road with his dusty friends. And it's precisely in this region, with all this around him, that he decides to pop the question. Now, in verse 13 of what we heard today from Matthew 16, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And Jesus comes in low, inviting almost a sort of a survey of public opinion. And that's not too hard. So his questions let him know. But understand, around him is all this activity and this mythology and this power play, and he comes up the question, well, who am I? Me? What do you guys say about me in the light of all this? And because he asks a survey question, they can handle that. Do you get stopped in the street by people who want to ask you questions? Supposedly a survey, well, it's low-level stuff like that. And they said in verse 14, some say John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. So their imagination is full of the Jewish scriptures, the Jewish history. That's all very interesting. But it's not really what Jesus is wanting to know. So he moves the conversation a step on. And he says in verse 15 to them, but who do you say I am? It's all very interesting knowing what the wider opinions are. And this is a moment of great tension. It can be validly said that this is the moment of tension on which the Gospels hinge. Especially Mark and Matthew are written that way. Because the big question is, who is Jesus? You can read story after story, you can read, you know, parable after parable. It's all nice stuff. But behind it is the question, well, who's talking? And until we get that clear, Jesus' ministry stays at a certain level. He kicks up a gear once this is clear. Who do you say I am? The disciples had heard the way people recognized Jesus as special, and that needed an explanation. So, as typically conservative, traditional people, anything good that happens today is the past revisited. They didn't have science fiction in those days. They didn't sort of imagine brave new futures and new worlds. The way you explain something is to think something special from the past is somehow working in the present. And that's how you explain it. So John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the prophets, that fits into that. But Jesus wants to hear a personal assessment from them here and now. And in verse 16, Simon Peter stumps up and says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Whoa! We have just moved up a whole plane. This is not something explained in terms of the past. This is explained in terms of God doing what God's been expected to do, and it's happening anew. It is momentous what he is saying. It's the biggest description he could offer. From heaven above, God's Son had come, and you're it. Jesus is excited, and he rejoices over this breakthrough. This is an absolute game changer. And Jesus answered in verse 17, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." It's a revelation. Have you ever sat in an almost dark room and there's a lightning flash outside and suddenly you see everything in an instant and you can remember what you saw? You know that experience. The lights aren't on, but one flash reveals to you where things are. Can be really, really important. That's just for me an illustration of how revelation worked in that instant. In some instant, Peter got it. He hadn't worked it out. He hadn't put one and one together or joined the dots. And he'd put his mouth into gear and spoken out what he had seen in his inner eye, as it were. He would later struggle to remember this. Don't think just because you see it once, it's always going to be something that you're absolutely sure on. But he saw it in this instance, and he said it. So for now, Jesus rejoices. And he does this in terms of where they are, because he starts referring to the context. And I tell you, because he's just been described as Simon Bar-Jonah, you are Peter, which you all know means rock. And on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. It's the only place in the Gospels where the word church or ecclesia is used. Now, do you see the connection is there, isn't it? And there are two things that I want to draw out. From the first, from the wider reference, we know that Peter is not a solid person in himself. The first leader of a church was a man who buckled. We know that, don't we? Mark's gospel in particular is like a narrative of discipleship failure. You know, some people want their religion to be full of great heroes. Christianity, apart from Jesus, isn't. It's a collection of saints, sinners, and fools. And Peter, you know, blessed be his name, we know was not solid in himself. But this confession he had just made was solid rock. Many years ago, I had the privilege of accompanying a family friend in his last days. Bill was dying of cancer. And Bill had worked with bricks, stones, plaster, and cement since he was 16. He knew stones. And the last time I saw him, we walked around a hospital corridor with his medication tower, and there was a nurse there as well. And Bill had a really gentle heart. And at one point he turned to the nurse and said, "You're a real brick." And it just melted my heart, because what he was saying to her was, "You're solid. You are someone that I can depend on and rest." If you didn't know the background, you could be offended, you know. "Gosh, what are you calling me?" But you're a brick. Does anyone know that idiom? Yeah, okay, you're solid. That's what I hear Jesus saying here in terms of this declaration that he's just made. If you believe through revelation that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God, I can build my church on you. But let us understand now with hindsight, not because he was such a rock solid person. That's because this revelation and his declaration of it is what Jesus was looking for. And so that's the first thing. Just a side comment before we move on. Just something really important. Jesus builds his church. Joshua, who builds his church? Man, good on you. I believe that is still true today. So I and others, let's not get in his way. Jesus is building his church. And then Jesus makes this statement. And it's the statement I've been orientating to in this message. and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Now, all that you see operating here will not snuff out the church that I will build on your profession of faith in me as God's Son, Messiah. The gates of Hades were physically modeled and operating nearby. The power of Rome had been attached to it. Jesus was saying that nothing that comes from this underworld, nothing that comes from all this religious and power play, nothing will be able to overcome the church that I'm building on your declaration of faith. Friends, we get to see enough history to recognize that the gates of Hades and all that that represents still makes big efforts to prevail against the church. It was said a lot in the early decades of the century, but the 20th century had more martyrs recorded for the faith than every previous century combined. And we're almost, you know, we're 19 years into this next century. There's no let up, is there? If you follow the reports, the attacks on the church, every which way around the world, there's no let up. And Jesus said, the gates of Hades will not prevail against the church that I'm building on your statement of faith. In Israel, it's obvious that God stands with his people. It's just everywhere. God is upholding the Jewish people. They will prevail. Jesus is saying that the church he builds will also prevail. And I take great comfort from that, because the news from around the world is not good, is it? The church is attacked from every which way. The blood of the martyrs just keeps on flowing. Jesus then says something I can't spend time on, but I'll just cover it briefly. The pagan world looked down to the world below. And what it imagined in the world below were gods who were a base version of ourselves. To call it a soap opera is to sanitize it. You know, the mythologies and the stories of the gods from pagan cultures around the world are brutal, gruesome, crude, ugly. And the people who worship this way, they get caught up in this evil spirituality. They get blinded by the mythologies and the idols. This is anti-holy. Anti-holy. The church of Jesus Christ is based on a faith that looks upward to heaven and recognizes that in Christ, in Jesus the man who walked on that land. The church of Jesus Christ is captivated by a vision of holiness. It's chalk and cheese. It is so different. And so Jesus says, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. The time would come. But at least among the disciples, that bridge had been crossed. So Peter and the others will be given access to the kingdom of heaven, not as a place in the future, but a connection now. But for now, don't tell anyone. So that's just one offering in terms of what Jesus said, the context he said it in. There's a lot more that I want to reflect on this. But let's ask a question. Do you have some Hades in your life? Is there, as it were, some source of or portal that bubbles up poison and knocks the life out of you? It may be a person, a colleague, a family member, a circumstance of some sort, that the gates of Hades are still oozing into your life. Jesus knows about that. That's part of the topography. That's part of the map, as it were. He didn't say, I'll block off the gates of Hades. He said, no, the gates of Hades won't prevail. The church and us will be able to stand against it. And he invites us to recognize this by entering into the faith of who he is and to focus on that. He invites us to be part of his church that corporately will never be overcome by any gates of Hades, whatever, however they manifest. And Jesus, in the rest of the Gospels, this is Matthew and Mark in particular, is practically going to demonstrate that now. It's a 200-kilometer walk from Caesarea Philippi to Jerusalem. And he starts that walk, 200 kilometers. We're going to hear, we hear through the Gospels a lot of what he said and a lot of what happened on that way. But what he's on his way to do is to face the power of the gates of Hades. Everything that can be thrown at him as a human being, as God's sent Messiah, as God's sent Son. And he's going in the faith that he will not be overcome. Now you know the story. It's a cross and a resurrection. Jesus walked the talk. So this is gospel. This is the gospel of our holy God who calls us to live in him, to prevail as his church, even when there are portals of evil and muck and unholiness all around us. And we will prevail in him in that profession of faith, no matter what is thrown at us, even death itself. Can you see why Jesus was waiting for that profession of faith? Because without that, no one would go there. No one would believe this. But it requires that. Shall we pray? I just invite you before the Lord now to answer that question. You tell the Lord who he is for you, who you believe him to be. Imagine you're being asked the question, who do you say I am?